So as you have heard so far today, as you have heard in our song a moment ago, it's Pentecost today. We celebrate Pentecost as one of the major feasts in the Christian year. And the traditional passage for Pentecost Sunday is from Acts chapter 2. That's the one we usually turn to on a Pentecost Sunday. And that's a remarkable reading. There's a major international festival going on in Jerusalem. There are people from all over the known world who are gathering together in Jerusalem. And we know that the Roman Empire was a very, very ethnically diverse place because of horrible things like slavery and wars, but also just movement of people was quite known throughout the empire. So in those days, people from all over the world really did mean from all over the known world anyway. And so the disciples of Jesus were gathered in a room, and then they go out. They burst out onto the streets full of his life. And the people hear the followers of Jesus speaking in their own languages. And if you know the Acts 2 reading, or you've ever had the privilege of reading it at church on a Sunday morning, there's a lot of different names and countries in there, isn't there? And there's 15 of them. And what's remarkable about this moment is these people who are gathered from all over the world can hear the disciples praising God in their own tongues and languages. And we're not going to be zooming in too deep on that reading today. We're going to be taking a bit more of a trajectory look at Pentecost today, because I want to go back in time a bit to Babel. We're going to talk about that. And then we're going to look at where Pentecost is heading. And that's where the Revelation 5 reading comes on. So we're going to do a bit of a sweep of lots of Bible today. And I wonder how familiar you are with the Tower of Babel. It's in one of the most ancient parts of the book of Genesis. It's a very mysterious reading, and it's quite a mysterious, murky kind of place in the Bible. It's beautiful. And we hear in the story of Babel the story of how humanity ended up speaking lots of different languages, because so Genesis goes, in the beginning, there was one language that everybody spoke. Just one language that all people had in common. And so the people got together and they said, well, we found this new technology, and that technology is the brick. And they said, if we have these bricks, we can build ourselves a tower and we'll make a name for ourselves and we will be like the gods. So God looks at this and says, well, if they speak all the same language, then everything they plan will work and nothing will be impossible for them. So let's confuse their language so that they don't understand each other. And so while people are working on this this big tower, this big city, God scatters them and he scatters their language, and they end up scattered over the whole world into different tribes, into different languages, and into different nations. Scattered is a really good word, don't you? I think we are scattered people, all of us. Our relationship with God is scattered. There's something damaged about that. And because of that, our relationship with other people, with other creatures, is damaged as well. And I'd say part of our condition, a part of the curse of Babel, is that we tend towards mistrust of people, full stop, but we also tend towards mistrust of people who are different from us. And that can be true, I think, in pretty much any way that people are capable of being different from each other, whatever that might be. So we can talk about in terms of race and language and ethnicity. It might be true in terms of personality, all sorts of other things, but we tend, so this isn't all we do, and it's not the only way we can think about human life, but we tend to gravitate towards people that are like us. And before we look at Revelation 5, I just want to notice that Acts 2 isn't exactly a reversal of Babel. I've heard Pentecost, so disciples coming out and speaking all these different languages. I've probably done this myself. It's undone or reversed the curse of Babel, and I think it's even better than that. You know, so it might have been a miracle for the Spirit of God to swoop into Jerusalem and make everybody who was in that city speak the same language. That would have been interesting, it would have been amazing, it would have been a miracle, but I think God does something even better, because God was speaking the languages of every single nation on earth. So what Pentecost doesn't do is push everyone back to being uniform, but God himself speaks in all the different languages. It takes every ethnicity, every language, every nation for Christ's kingdom to be fully realized. And again, something very, I think unique about Christianity, I may be wrong on this, but I think compared to almost every other religion, Christianity doesn't have a carrier language or culture. So it doesn't belong to a certain people or a certain group or a certain nation. So to be a Christian, you don't need to start dressing in a different way. You don't need to start speaking a different language. This is one of the big questions that the early church had. What do we do? All these men and women who've been brought up as Jews, when people who were Greeks or from every other country in the world want to join us. And they worked out again and again. They said, look, we have to open this wider, because it takes more than just one people speaking one language to show us what Christ is like. And then let's turn now to Revelation 5. I want to see the end point of that. So if you think of an arrow that got sent off at Pentecost, I think this is a picture the Bible gives us of where this lands. And so it's on page 1237, really near the end of the Bible. So if you get to the maps of the Holy Land, you've gone too far, but not that too far. So it's just a few pages in on 1237. We see this absolutely fantastic scene. I think fantastic is the right word for it. Revelation is a really dense book. There are lots of vivid images and lots of rich symbols. There are a set of visions that Jesus gave to a man called John. And the chapters of Genesis often begin with things like, I looked, I watched, I saw. So we see at the top of chapter 5 there, and then I saw. So this is, he's not going anywhere. He's just in his house or his cell or his chapel or wherever he is. And God is giving him these tremendously rich visions. And anyone who's ever studied Revelation will tell you it's incredibly dense, and there's lots of ways of reading lots of things. But I think this passage just shows us something ultimately quite simple in the midst of all the complex bits. So the scene is a heavenly throne room, and chapter 4 gives us a bit more of a picture of that. So we have God on the throne in the middle, and it describes it in chapter 4 as one like jasper and ruby. And all the way around, it says, I can't remember where I've got that, jasper and ruby, and then jasper and carnelian, it says, and a rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. So can you imagine this shining throne with some kind of super sparkling rainbow circling all the way around it? And again, we're in some very, very bizarre imagery here, aren't we? But it's a scene of glory. And this God is on his throne. He's surrounded by 24 other thrones. And those are the thrones, I said, of the elders. That's those in the Christian community. And there's lightning and there's thunder coming out of the throne. And there are four terrifying, monstrous living creatures with different faces, each of them. So it says, therefore, with one like a lion, one like an ox, one like a man, one like a flying eagle. And they've all got six wings, and these elders and these creatures are just worshipping at the throne of God day and night. And in chapter 5, we see a problem arises in this scene. There's a scroll in God's hand. And this scroll has got writing on both sides, and it's sealed with seven seals. And what exactly this scroll means, and there's different opinions out there exactly what that is. So in the book I read, there were six different options, and the guy just laid it out and said, look, these are six of the ways you can think about it. But I think the most likely way of understanding this scroll is it represents somehow God's plan for the whole universe. It's somehow this scroll is like the key to life itself. So there's this scroll in God's hand, and nobody, verse 3, nobody in heaven or earth could open the scroll or indeed even look inside it. And verse 4, so John, who's watching this scene, weeps and weeps. He's so upset that there's this scroll that needs to be opened, and there's nobody in heaven or on earth who's worthy to open this scroll, who's worthy to unlock the very meaning of life itself. And in the middle of this scene steps forth a slain bloody lamb. Strange thing, in the middle of this scene, the person who can open this scroll is a slain lamb. And the original Christians reading this will have seen straight away, well, this is Jesus, this is our Passover lamb, the one who was slain for us. He is the one in the middle of this, not appearing as a mighty warrior, as he does elsewhere in Revelation, not even appearing as a kind of a wise teacher, but appearing in the middle of this throne room as a slain bloody lamb. And the Passover lamb takes the scroll and opens it. And as he opens it, the heavens erupt in worship. So in the first part of the worship, in verse 9, we see the elders and the creatures. So these monstrous creatures with six wings and different shaped faces. And then these elders, they start saying, "You are worthy of this lamb." It's at the bottom of the first column there on page 9. "You are worthy to take the scroll and to open its seals, because you were slain, and with your blood you purchased people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. You've made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign in the earth." But that's just the appetizer. Because the next scene you see, down in verse 11, the voice of many angels, it says 10,000 times 10,000. So he's literally got this vision of 100 million angels bellowing, shaking the universe with their worship for God. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Wembley Stadium or the Camp Nou or one of those amazing football stadiums or those huge stadiums. You stand in the middle of it, or the Royal Albert Hall even, you stand in the middle of it and you're just taken back. Can you imagine that 1,000 times bigger? 1,000 Wembley stadiums in big circles going round and round, and in the middle of that, this slain lamb, and they say, "Worthy is the lamb who was slain." And then it gets even bigger, because after that, every creature in heaven and earth, that's in verse 13, every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them, the whole of creation, the whole of the cosmos, coming together and singing, "To him who sits on the throne and to the lamb, be praise and honour and glory and power forever and ever." And we see at the centre of this, the whole of creation, 100 million angels, every person who's caught in Christ, worshipping together. And at the centre, not the one who rules by the sword, but by the one who rules by sacrifice, the one who died to make a scattered people his own. So the end point of Pentecost is the same reason that God made people, and that's the same reason that God made people different, because it takes a scene that big, that colourful, that diverse, to really and truly show how glorious Jesus is. I think if we think of that as the end point, I think it makes some of the way that we might think about diversity and things like that in our church far richer than the story that the world gives us. I think the church can and does have a far richer view and a far richer story of equality and diversity than the world does. And so we need to recognise that we are still under the curse of Babel in so many ways. You know, we recognize and experience racism is real, tribalism is real, nationalism. And so we need to lament those things and to speak out against them. We can can speak out about injustice when we see it. We think of, I mean, just a couple of the heroes that come to mind quite easily, Martin Luther King, William Wilberforce, and for every one of them, hundreds and thousands of others whose names we don't know. But I think that we can do that in a much better way than the world tends to. I think the way the world at the moment talks about race and diversity can be very reductive and very cynical even, you know, reduces all relationships basically down to exploitation. Someone's exploiting someone. Or it can be really depersonalizing as well. Some of the way that we can in our culture talk about race just reduces people simply down to their ethnic groups. And I think, so that's one of the things I've just noticed. Is I don't know how many of you have been taking an interest in some of the way that these things are spoken about in the press, spoken about in the world. I think whether you tend towards a more kind of progressive-y, kind of left-wingish view on this, or whether you tend towards a more conservative one, wherever you sit, however you responded to that race inquiry that was published a few weeks back, it feels that in some of the ways these things are talked about, it's paranoia and lack of trust becomes almost like the main kind of way we talk about these things. And I think it's because our worldly visions of equality are really inadequate and two-dimensional. Because when we take the image of God really seriously together, we will really lament and hate racism and injustice when we see it. We'll see it as a blasphemy. It's nothing less than a sin against the living God who made people in his image. But we also see that what it is to be human goes above and beyond every distinction that there is between us. So those distinctions we have are important. But what we have in common as people made by God in his image is actually more significant than what is different between us. And I'd say that the curse of Babel reigns and shows every time those distinctions become ultimately important rather than Christ. That's when chaos reigns. And actually as Christians we can say we have a better way of talking about this than we'll find in the world. And so can I just suggest as a church, perhaps we can be brave. So rather than either see racism as a problem we need to solve in the kind of, you know, just we have to kind of continually get to the bottom of something, or as something we just don't think about because we'd rather not and, hey, we don't experience it much ourselves, perhaps there's a middle way. Rather than being colour blind, we could be colour brave. Maybe we can talk to each other about how our different experiences of how our culture, our language, our colour has affected our life. We can hear each other. So maybe we don't need to be nervous about asking that to one another. And I think we can also choose to reflect our diversity, our God-given diversity, in the way that we choose to do things, in the way that we choose to worship. We can allow one another to shape our view of God. I think it takes a particular kind of grace to do that. As I said, our natural inclination is life is easier if we all think the same, isn't it? Or we see things in the same way. And that's just not the way that God has set us up, is it? He wants us to be glorified. We need a particular kind of grace to do that. But we will glorify God in a particularly amazing kind of way. The more diverse we are, the more we can glorify Christ when we really are showing and living out that unity, because we will show the world that we are not operating in the same categories as they are. And we even think about that in terms of worship. I'd like, just as I come to an end here, I'd like to imagine you're celebrating a birthday party for your child, and you buy a cake, you invite your friend, invite their friends, and you give her presents. And now imagine discussing the party with your spouse or another adult later that night, and they say, "So what did you make of the party?" And you say, "Well, I don't know. I didn't really get anything out of it. It didn't really impact me. It didn't really feed me very well. No one brought me presents. We sang Happy Birthday with a guitar, but I'd far rather hear it on an organ." And so you think to yourself, if someone says that, you think, well, you've kind of missed the point of it, haven't you? Because the point is actually not about us, but it's about the Jesus that we're worshipping together. And so again, this is a wonderful thing that happens in a Christian community where we take our own preferences, cultural, our personality, the way we think about worship, all these things, and we say to God, they're important, but they're not the most important thing. That's why in our church life over these next few weeks and months, I really want us to be more conscious about wanting to be diverse proudly in the way that we worship together. And as we do that, we'll find nothing less than a sign of heaven. We'll be not fully displaying Revelation 5, but we'll be pointing towards it. It'll be prophetic. Because our worship together is a sign. It's a dim sign. It's an incomplete sign. It's a dimly diverse people. We're dimly unified. We're dimly worshipping with a dim awareness of the deep beauty of Christ. That will be a sign, won't we, of what that's going to come one day. A fully diverse people, fully unified, fully worshipping Christ in full awareness of his deep beauty. That's nothing less than Jesus prayed for us that night when he was with his disciples. He said to them, I've given them the glory that you gave me, so they may be one as we are one. May they be brought to complete unity. And the world will know that you have sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me.